It's hardcore history.
Addendum.
So my apologies if today's show sounds a little like you're joining a conversation that's already in progress. But this has happened with me before, where I'll be talking with someone about something, usually over a long period of time, you know, messaging back and forth or whatever it might be. And I'll think to myself, usually a little too late in the game, wow, you know, should have thought about making this a podcast. I mean, more people than just yours truly might want to hear what's being said here. And that's how today's show got started. Just an ongoing discussion that at a certain point, you look at it and you go, well, I should have started recording a long time ago. But so if it sounds like you're picking up the conversation in the middle of it, you might be. I've never been that good in the conversations or the interviews, as you probably know if you've heard me, of really like setting it up and starting at ground zero and building from a place of no knowledge and eventually getting somewhere in the conversation that's interesting. We just go right to the interesting, and I hope it all makes sense without having all the background, but that's what today's program will be like. So I had a conversation that was ongoing about, of all things, military aircraft, especially military aircraft in the Second World War. At times it got very specific, you know, the P-38 American fighter plane in the Second World War. But I was having a discussion with Elon Musk, and we were talking about the role of engineers in warfare. And that's a famous history, right? Go back to Archimedes, supposedly killed by the Roman soldier when he's doodling in the sand and he didn't want to be interrupted, and he made all those supposedly, I think, Mythbusters. Well, in their own way, figured out that some of this stuff probably wouldn't work, but, you know, they're not Archimedes either. But, you know, the history of warfare with these engineers creating weapons, and, of course, in the modern world, those people are monumentally more important than they were in primitive times, although somebody invented a bow and arrow someday, the early military engineers. But Mr. Musk and I were talking about this, and at a certain point I thought, okay, this is a pretty good thing to just have a podcast about. Now, my worry was that we were going to get into the minutiae of, like, turbo supercharged engines and the performance of different aircraft at different altitudes based on the octane rating in the fuel. And I'm not saying we didn't do any of that. I'm just saying it turned out to be more interesting than I thought it was going to be when we did get there. I want to issue a little disclaimer at the outset. I am the worst person in the world to talk to about engineering. If there's any sort of engineering knowledge required in the conversation on my end, I'm a guy that can't, you know, hammer a nail into a board, so I'm an idiot. So if I don't look like I know what I'm doing here, well, you know, not only that, but if you wanted to say which of the three branches of service in the 20th century militaries, you know, land, sea, and air, that I was least confident that I wouldn't look like an idiot talking about, it would be aircraft. So we're just going to hold on and see if we can keep up with a guy who loves this stuff and understands it at a level I'll never be able to appreciate. And just in case his own knowledge wasn't enough, he brought in one of the best engineers at SpaceX, Mr. Bill Riley, to come in and back him up on this stuff. So one way or another, we should get this stuff right, I would think, with the three of us. In any case, I hope you enjoy this discussion with Elon Musk talking about, well, I guess it started off with him saying that engineers don't get enough credit in warfare. And, well, you know, we'll touch upon a little high-octane fuel and turbo supercharged engines along the way. Without further ado, Elon Musk and Mr. Bill Riley from SpaceX. So what I thought was, I'll give the background about how the hell this even, you know, got started in terms of our conversation. Sure. And then what I thought maybe we could start off with, you know, you had talked a lot about how this was an engineer's war. And I thought to myself that the Second World War, of course, was not the first engineer's war. You can go back into history and you can find these moments, the famous, the Romans inventing the Corvu device to help them win the naval war in the First Punic Wars, all those kinds of things. But those are so rare because of the pace of technological change being so much more slow. And then you get to something like the Franco-Prussian War, maybe, but certainly in the First World War, where aircraft development becomes a race. And that if you develop the next new thing, you might control the skies for the next 4 or 5 months until the other side catches up. So maybe you could tell me a little bit about this whole engineer's war kind of concept.
Yeah, absolutely. So for a lot of books on strategy on war, actually don't address technology or address it in a tangential manner. But obviously, if there is an overwhelming technology advantage, that side will win, even if the odds are dramatically stacked against them from a numerical standpoint, or even if the other side has better generalship and is very smart. If there is a big technology discontinuity, then the side with the advanced technology will win. And as you alluded to, most battles in history, because technology moved very slowly, it was more about maneuvering and about tactics and strategy and whatnot. But to use sort of an extreme example, if, for example, you can shoot lasers from space to any point on the ground by pointing at it, it would not matter if you were fighting Julius Caesar, Heinz Guderian, Napoleon. They just got lasered from space. So there's no, it's sort of, when there's a technology discontinuity, that just fundamentally flips the whole situation. And in the wars in the modern era, we're very much a technology race war. Like, they were just, how fast can we innovate the technology? I mean, obviously, an extremely good example of that would be, perhaps the best example would be the nuclear bomb. Anyone who got nuclear bombs, that you now win. That's it. Over. End of story. And the reason for the U.S. Manhattan Project, which I'd like to emphasize, was very much a function of the physics community more than it was the government. People think that this was a government thing. The government certainly supported it, but it was a decision by the physics community, without which it certainly would not have happened. And the physics community simply came to the conclusion that we cannot let Hitler have the bomb, obviously, and so we must make it first and be certain of it. So that's an example of you've just got some super weapon that anyone who gets it wins. No better example than nuclear weapons. So, but I think these technologies played a much stronger role in a war than is generally understood. And technology is to be viewed in the broadest sense. You could also think of it in the sense of, say, do you have a better phalanx? Do you have spears that are bronze or iron or steel? That's a big difference. And one of the things that the Romans had were, they had actually quite good metallurgy. So they had their swords. There's two general phases, steel, austenite and martensite. Their swords were more martensitic. And so they had swords that did not bend as much. And so they'd often be fighting others who had swords that were much more ductile and basically bend over a Roman sword. So obviously, if you're in a sword fight and your sword just bends like a noodle, it doesn't work as well after that. So the Romans actually, I think, won their wars through technology. Obviously, the internal wars, they were more equal technology footing. But when fighting outside the Roman Empire, they would win their wars, or sometimes lose their wars, for technology. So when the Romans fought the Scythians or Scythians, they really did not have a good counter to the mounted war archer. And especially if they get lured into terrain that is flat and easy to maneuver for horses, then they're pretty much hopeless against the technology of a mounted archer. And Genghis Khan took full advantage of the whole mounted archer thing, obviously, as most people who study anything about this know. But looking at, say, the World War II and fighter plane advancement, bomber advancement, it's perhaps interesting to go into kind of how things started out and then how fast things innovated and the technology war of specifically going into the fighters and some degree bombers of World War II. And I'd like to say that, I think there was very impressive design work around fighters done by many countries. So Japan, US, Germany, UK, Russia, and others had some very impressive fighter designs. And then the US obviously completely crushed it on the bomber front. So, but things didn't quite start out that way. At the beginning of World War II, when there would be fights between, say, in the Pacific theater, between U.S. aircraft and Japanese aircraft, there would sometimes be cases. There would be cases where the entire U.S. squadron was shot down for zero losses on the Japanese side. Just, you know, total KO. And because the U.S. fighters really at the beginning of World War II were not very good, and nor were the tactics, and nor was the training. So it's basically the tactics are terrible, the aircraft are terrible, and the training is not correct.
Well, wait, you bring up something interesting, though, because, I mean, you brought up lasers earlier, and I think we can all agree that if you go to some primitive planet where everyone's in caveman-type times and you have lasers, it's game over.
Yeah.
But there are smaller levels of technological discrepancy, right? Bronze weapons versus iron weapons, or the latest aircraft versus the aircraft from 5 minutes ago, right? Or you mentioned a second ago tactics. Well, you know, one of the things that... You know, there's so much that you learn when you first start learning about the world wars, for example. And then as you delve farther into it, you learn many of the more intricate things like tactics. So, for example, how American fighter pilots would have tactics to try to overcome the fact that they're flying inferior machines, right? The thatch weave and all these sorts of things where they try to take advantage of.
Yeah, the thatch weave is a great example. Yeah, exactly. The thatch weave was a great example of improvement in tactics. If you're fighting a nimble, this was developed in the U.S. in response to the Japanese fighters, which were very agile,
nimble,
very nimble,
yeah, nimble.
And so if you're in a thing that's sort of more like a tank, and you're fighting something which is, you know, extremely nimble, but you're not nimble, but you've got better armor, then the you basically want to just let the nimble fighter get on your tail, and then let your squadron mate come back and come behind you and shoot that plane down while it's trying to shoot you down. But it takes a long time to shoot you down because you've got a lot of armor. So that's like a in a nutshell the thatch weave, and you just could do that back and forth. It made a big difference.
Well, and you also have the stuff that always drives me crazy, and that I was always so worried you were going to take me into this territory when we talked, and I was going to look like an idiot. But I mean, for example, things like super turbochargers and being able to take the enemy to altitudes,
yes,
where your plane's better than their plane. I mean, the
That's
intricacies and all this stuff. Yeah, okay, so let me ask you this then, because we were just talking about choices in war, and if you have the laser beam and the other guy doesn't, they're through. But, I mean, one of the things, and it's funny that I could be a history major and all these things for years, but it took a video game to make me really think about some of the production trade-offs, right? The stuff that's not so sexy for a war gamer. Things like, is it better or where's the sweet spot to build a lot of one design where you already have the production line geared up to build Sherman tanks or T-34 tanks, or is it better to build a much smaller amount of much more sophisticated things? So Hitler making multiple choices on jet fighters and jet bombers, or maybe would you rather have 20,000 T-34s or 1,100 Tiger IIs? How does one, if I put you in charge, if I said, Elon, come in here in Second World War, help us make these trade-off decisions, do you have any thoughts on those kinds of trade-offs?
Well, I think it's going to be kind of like in a war game, you know, so if you've got, let's say you have something with a particular kill ratio. Let's say if your kill ratio is 3, and the thing costs twice as much, then you should still do that thing because you're going to be better off. It only costs twice as much, but it has a 3-to-1 kill ratio.
So what about something like then adjustments. So like when I think of, you know, one of the things they used to teach us in the military history classes was that if you're facing another opponent, the side that has the technological advantage is at its greatest disparity at the very beginning of the conflict. And that the longer the conflict goes on, the more time the adversary has to adjust and come up with countermeasures. So that's how tribal peoples in Afghanistan maybe adjust to being the technologically inferior side. Could one make a case today that there are examples of that? You know, the U.S. still, I would assume, correct me if I'm wrong, the technological leader there in military technology. But if you're the Russians or the Chinese and we end up in a war in 20 years, are there ways that they can compensate for the fact that they're behind on certain? I mean, is an electromagnetic pulse attack something that helps compensate for a satellite discrepancy? I know we're jumping around here. That's sorry.
Still gonna jump around.
I do think if I could jump in though, I think there's an interesting thing here too, which is your rate of innovation might be the key after the first opening salvos. Because if you're able to innovate faster, you can make up ground. For example, you know, the first Mustangs had the Allison engines and they weren't good at altitude, but you put a Rolls-Royce turbo supercharged and then you get a really good all-around fighter. So it might be that the rate of innovation and ability to adapt to like the basically the game of rock, paper, scissors that Elon and I often talk about. Like when there's a better scissors out there, you need a better rock, or the Butter Battle Book by Dr. Seuss. But, you know, you're always chasing the next widget.
Rate of innovation is the key.
Okay, so what about the reverse engineering aspect then? So famously, one of the stories from the Second World War is the U.S. getting their hands on a relatively intact Zero fighter, I think it was in the Aleutian Islands, and being able to take that apart and maybe gain 6 months of time that they wouldn't have had before in the development phase. Any thoughts on those kinds of things, the ability to maybe learn from your adversary?
Yeah, if we sort of put ourselves in the position of like, hey, it's our job to design advanced fighters, for sure we'd love to see an enemy fighter or even allied fighter and take it apart and take a look at the small engineering decisions that we think would be interesting. What materials they use, what joining methods, like, you know, if it's a reciprocating engine, what pressure were they running the cylinders at, what are they using for O-rings. It's a ton of things like that. But for example, something like just like material properties that you can count on make a big difference. So if you're using, say, a high-strength aluminum sheet for a stress skin wing, you may have material properties, depending on how that alloy is made, that could be variable. And then that forces you to use the lower end of what that variable strength might be, and thus make the skins thicker, thus make the plane heavier. And then you've got a knock-on effect where if the wings are heavier, now the landing gear needs to be heavier, engine needs to be more powerful, you get this recursive effect of mass. So on the other hand, if you can count on very tight material specs, now you can design the plane to use thinner wing skins, because you don't have to account for the fact that maybe this batch of aluminum was not that good. Things like that actually make a big deal, are a big deal. In World War II, with the fighter situation, a big factor was what octane rating could you count on for the engine?
The fuel, yeah.
It's a huge deal.
The Americans had the high octane stuff.
Yeah, really. So if you
you're going to like that Adam Tooze book we were talking about, because one of the things that he focused on that I'd never heard about in terms of Second World War importance was he was talking about the rare materials, the tungsten type stuff and all the sorts of things I couldn't tell you five little things about. And they were talking about what a huge deal it was the Germans would invent this wonderful new weapon like something like a cone bore gun, for example, but required tungsten to make it work. So the scientists have created this wonderful new weapon, but the state does not have the ability to get the basic materials you need to have that weapon work. And a huge part of the whole war thing was who has the rare materials and where do you get them from and how do you jury rig it when you don't have it, you know, domestically. That's fascinating stuff. That's right up your alley.
Yeah, absolutely. Germany and I think Japan as well were really operating from a position of really not having good access to high quality fuel and limited access to rare materials. But I think it's not so much the rare materials that matters. It's just like if you need, you know, the you really want a plane's body and frame is going to be primarily aluminum, and a simple thing like, can you count on what are your A basis material allowables? B basis, you know, basically, do you have to make the skin 10% thicker to account for variability in the quality of the aluminum or aluminium, as it should be called? That's going to make, if your plane is now 10% heavier at a structural level because of strength variation in the aluminum that you've been sent, then that will actually have a knock-on effect on everything else. The recursive effect.
Sure, speed, maneuverability, everything.
Yeah, but
right?
There's a recursive effect of mass. So
it's a mass begets mass, as we say, right?
Yes, mass begets mass. So, you know, if your primary structure is 10% heavier because you had to take a 10% knockdown because of variable materials, now everything's going to have to be heavier too. You need a more powerful engine to go at the same speed, and especially to climb at the same speed. You need bigger landing gear. You need more fuel because you're carrying a heavier plane. All these things amplify the mass of any one. So you increase mass in one area. It actually causes the mass of everything else to increase as well. And Germany actually did a ton of clever things to try to improve the octane rating of fuel, like tons of additives and all sorts of things, because they would just get random fuel that was pretty bad, whereas the US had awesome fuel. And so they really took it to the, you know, very, very high octane. And as Bill was saying, the Merlin engine, and really the best Merlin engine was the one made in the US. that was the turbo supercharged Merlin made in the US for the P-51 with such a kick-ass engine. It's insane. I mean, and quite frankly, that's the kind of thing where I'm sure that the Germans captured some aircraft that had the sort of state-of-the-art, you know, a P-51D, you know,
that would have been late war though, 44-45.
Yeah, but it that's a case where you could hand it to them and the blueprints, and it wouldn't matter because that engine is actually so difficult to make that it's irrelevant. So,
isn't that a British engine originally?
Yes, it's originally a British engine, which was then enhanced in the US.
Okay.
So the actual best one was in my opinion, and maybe different opinions out there, but the best one was the British Merlin engine design, and but then further enhanced with the US turbo supercharging, which led to the Mustang being this incredible long range high altitude fighter. And but you couldn't, if you got low octane fuel in that engine, you'd have a real problem. So
okay, but let me talk about that, because this is something most people, yours truly included, don't understand, and you might have to use small words with me, Elon, for a minute. So but like if Dan Carlin looks at the aircraft performance, I'm going to look at the firepower, I'm going to look at the armor, I'm going to look at the turn radius, I'm going to look at the top speed, I'm going to look at the climb rate, and I'm not going to look at the octane level. But the Americans had the extreme octane fuel, which I was reading that as the war went on and the Axis fuel got worse and worse,
yeah,
quality, that this advantage became more and more pronounced. What does it mean to have higher octane fuel if you're a pilot? What can you do that the guy with the lower octane fuel,
sure,
can't?
So if you have the lower octane fuel, you get pre-combustion. So basically get knocking. So
it reminds me of the old gasoline, yeah, commercials, the knocking and the pinging.
Yeah,
exactly. The air fuel mixture ignites before you're ready for it, and in a non-optimal way, that robs power and can lead to mechanical failure, essentially.
Okay, so if you're the other pilot with the lower octane fuel, besides the knocking and the pinging and the lower power, does that mean you lose? You know, so if conceivably your plane should be able to go 400 miles per hour, but you're using inferior fuel, does that lower your top speed? I'm trying to figure out how it works for the pilots involved when they're trying to make their calculations.
Yeah, you would see it show up as power, and then your power as you go to different altitudes.
Yeah,
and then you can't.
So what's the role of the supercharger then? Is that a high altitude, low oxygen thing?
Yes, the turbochargers or superchargers are increasing the combustion pressure. So, like basically enabling, you're basically, if you go up high, you're the air's very thin. So if you're just taking air with a normal carburetor, you're going to be oxygen stopped, just as a human is oxygen stopped. So you've got to pressurize that air coming in and feed the engine very high pressure air so that it can continue to produce high power at altitude. And then you're also going to have a major cooling problem. that's the why the Mustang had that gigantic cooling thing under the fuselage, which is then also made dual use of as kind of like a jet. It has a slight jet effect. There's a name for it, I forget, but even though it looks
like the Meredith effect.
Meredith effect, exactly. So it offset the drag of the gigantic radiator, basically. That's that was under the fuselage of the P-51. But frankly, if the octane is not high enough, you will get mechanical damage to the engine, and the plane will break. You know, so the engine will fail. So it's not just it's not as good. It's like also it might conk out on you while you're over the Pacific or over, enemy territory, and that will be not great. So octane is a super big deal.
This reminds me of another conversation you and I had, and it's made me think ever since. And it had to do with the plane I think is one of your favorites, the P-38 yeah. Lightning. And this is another problem that happens to you when you study this like I do, as opposed to flying these planes like other people do, which is you had said to me having the two engines would be really important if you lost one of them. And I remember thinking
for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, that's not the kind of thing when you're thinking about this in a wargaming sense or an overall strategic sense. You're not thinking about an individual pilot or whatnot. But that was a revelation for me. So for those who don't know, the P-38 is the one that looks like it's two planes sort of fused together. It's a classic American design. We ended up making what the P-61's like that, too, I think. Tell me a little about that plane, because you waxed eloquently on that for a while to me before. Came out in like, what, 38, 39, the design?
Yeah, it didn't really get good until a couple of years later. And I think they actually could have taken the P-38 Lightning much further than they did. Like, if you put, for example, state-of-the-art Mullen engines, like the P-51 got, like the Mustang got, man, that would be an epic plane. Insane. P-38 was, it's worth noting, like, I believe most of the top American aces, if not all, flew P-38s. And now the P-38 is not like it was as designed. It was not great in any theater of war. But it was great in the Pacific theater. But it was ultimately superseded by the F-6F Hellcat, which this is like an interesting bit of trivia. If you say what was the most effective fighter plane in World War II, and the actual answer is the Hellcat, because.
What was the criteria you used for that?
The kill ratio. So,
okay. Well, that has there's a lot of other variables though that go into
that. Yeah, but I mean, if you're in a battle, that's the thing that matters. So,
yeah, but what about? But you got pilot skill. We just talked about octane fuel. There's tactics. There's, I mean, I can think of a lot of things that might go into what. What accounts for a kill ratio besides just the, I mean, would you rather have a Hellcat than a Corsair or a Mustang?
Well, you couldn't really have a Mustang unless you've got a Mustang is not a carrier aircraft.
It's a land-based plane.
Yeah. So first of all, it's important to note, like if you're on a carrier, you're constrained in volume. Like you can't have like a giant plane or your plane. There's some limitations on plane size. You've got to fold the wing, so you're going to lose. You're going to have some
right
weight added because you've got a folding wing. The stall speed has to be super low so that you can land this thing on a very tiny runway that's in the wind. It's a carrier, like that's not long. So as you say, you've got to have a slow stall speed or slow landing speed. That also impedes the design of the vehicle, but. Really, I mean, for its day, there was no better plane in the Pacific theater than the F-6, the Hellcat. It was just crushingly good. Like it was it did the best at the rock, paper, scissors situation. And I believe had something like a 13-to-1 kill ratio. So that's a nutty number. Just nutty. And this is pilot skill is not, I would say was not a significant factor in this, because most of the pilots of those planes had never been in combat or had been in combat to a very, very limited degree. The Hellcat was actually intentionally designed so that someone who had a small number of flight hours would be able to fly it safely. Because besides being shut down by an enemy aircraft, there's also landing on the carrier and not crashing.
It's a subtle point, yes.
Yeah. These things don't land themselves.
So Elon, wait a minute. So you talked now a couple of times about the rock, paper, scissors dynamic when it comes to aircraft. Now, in naval development, that's easy. We say speed, armor, gunfire. What does the rock, paper, scissors apply to in air combat or air development?
Sure. And both, please weigh in whenever you'd like. But, you know, if you take Pacific Theater for a while, you have the Zero, which is really an awesome design, extremely agile. And you know, really cool in a lot of ways, light and really, really effective. And like I said, in the early air battles in the Pacific, the Zero would absolutely dominate.
And they had better pilots in the early war too, though. That does come into play, doesn't it? Those are veteran pilots flying those Zeros. Flying in China, flying, you know, all of that stuff.
Yeah. I think the I mean, U.S. started off with the worst planes, the worst tactics, and the worst training.
That's true. I'm not going to argue with that. No, I'm not going to argue with that.
pretty bad, really. I mean, it's rough seeing some of those early battles where, man, those kids never stood a chance.
No.
So the Zero was for sure the superior thing in the beginning to the U.S. fighters. But very, very quickly, the U.S. evolved the training, the tactics, and the technology. And then the thing is, so if the U.S. starts off with paper, and say Japan has scissors, what's a rock in this case? So, the rock in this case really was the best rock, and this is just, you know, looking at actual battle stats, was the carrier-based F-6F Hellcat. Now, this is not a pretty plane. And the reason there are very few of these around is because it's not the best-looking aircraft, frankly.
They're bulky, aren't they? They're kind of bulky. Like P-47s are bulky. The Brewster Buffalo was bulky.
It's bulky and frankly, not a handsome plane. So
a lot of armor,
blocky and kind of cool, but this is blocky and didn't look that good. But it's a kick-ass fighter. It is then the rock to the scissors that is the Zero. And so with the F-6F, really great design. It's literally designed it with the intent of we're going to have a whole bunch of new pilots who've never been in combat, have landed very few times on a carrier. And you know, some of them are just not that good. There's not that good at flying, really. So they just got conscripted, and they were riding a tractor in Kansas until not that long ago. So it was designed with that in mind. It's like let's make this thing easy to fly, easy to land, so non-combat casualties low, easy to maintain, make the wings easy to fold, so you can stow them really real fast and get them ready for flight real fast. We're going to give them heavy guns. So we've got 50 cals, and we're going to give this thing a lot of armor. Okay, so it's got a lot of armor. It's got a lot of power. And this is a big. This is actually quite a big plane. So you see the size of this thing. It's looks like a bull.
I think almost four times the power of the Zero.
Right. So big ass engine, and just really robust to fire. Especially to lower caliber bullets. So if it's being shot with 303s or something like that, lower caliber bullets, it's basically taking a shower. It doesn't care, you know?
Did they have self-sealing tanks and all that kind of stuff too? The Japanese were not big on. Yeah, okay.
Totally. So you got you get fuel tanks to seal themselves. It was very carefully armored. So it had like heavy duty armor in the right places. And so what would happen is Zero would get on the back, on the tail of a Hellcat, and would just be peppering the thing, like guns blazing, pressing the fire button. It's going, and that's, this thing is just not coming down. Okay. So it didn't matter that the Hellcat was not that maneuverable.
So you know what, though? You're making me think of a whole different class of planes, though, and I hope you don't mind me shifting here, because now you've got me thinking about, one of the planes I was always kind of interested in was something like, you know, Henschel was making a ground attack aircraft. They had a 126 and a 129, and they were a combination of super heavily armored planes, really not very maneuverable, not very fast, because they were flying tanks, and then a gun that was more suited to a tank, too, and trying to figure out, you know, how you handle a massive recoil of a heavy gun in an aircraft and whatnot. Any thoughts or any insights into something like the ground attack aircraft? Because these days, we would look at aircraft as being, and all during the Cold War, the idea of how the U.S. was going to compensate for this massive armored thrust through the Fulda Gap in Central Europe or something was going to be with aircraft that just took out all these tanks, which, of course, is really a Second World War development. Any thoughts on the idea of ground attack aircraft?
Yeah. So if you, it's like I said, it's just think of these things as very much rock, paper, scissors. And, you know, it's hard to be a master of all trades. So you really want to have like the right aircraft for the right use, and ground attack aircraft you really need to be heavily armored on the bottom and around the engine cowling, because that's where the bullets are coming from. And you want to be probably pretty fast. You don't want to be staying down on the deck for too long if you're doing scraping runs. But like, for example, the P-51 was an amazing high-altitude fighter, but it was not so great as a ground attack aircraft because it was vulnerable from the bottom. The armor on the bottom was much more limited, and it had the oil cooler, that oil cooler we're talking about that provided some thrust using the Meredith effect was vulnerable from the bottom. So the Mustang was geared towards your combat with fighter aircraft, and so was quite good in that respect, very good in that respect. But they had a lot of planes down because of ground attacks, where they basically, at some point, there just weren't any more fighters to deal with, so the Mustangs would go down and do ground attack. But they got shot down quite a bit in ground attack because they weren't well suited for that. You'd want something that's got a lot of heavy armor from the direction the bullet's coming, which is in the bottom, and not much, you don't want to have too much vulnerable stuff there. Assuming if you're doing strafing runs, and if you're doing bombing, that's a whole different subject. So,
you know, I'm trying to think about the most impactful fighter war of all time, right? Because, you know, like you said, bombing's a different thing. But to me, I'm thinking of like when fighters and fighter development, not just in terms of the development of the planes themselves, but the tactics, the strategies and all this stuff. Can you think? I think the Battle of Britain's got to be the most impactful, mostly concerned with a fighter technology sort of thing. And you have Spitfires and Hurricanes on one side, you have Focke Wulfs and Messerschmitts on the other. Any thoughts on the Battle of Britain and the whole ebb and flow of the technological rock, paper, scissors game going on in that one?
Sure. Britain mostly had like Spitfires and Hurricanes. And now, the Spitfires and Hurricanes also went through very rapid evolution. So you say Spitfire, you say which one? Literally, depending upon.
Right, which very A, B, C, D, they all sound like that,
exactly.
Right?
They were rapidly iterating versions of the Spitfire and Hurricane so friggin' fast that you have to like say which month, or maybe even which week and which month was that fighter built. So Britain did actually an incredible job of rapidly evolving Spitfire and Hurricane. And actually, Germany did a great job too. The Focke Wulf and Messerschmitt were amazing. But they're really operating at a significant disadvantage from a range standpoint. So the if you're doing these sort of like these maneuvers all over the place, where just cranking full throttle, climbing and diving, you're using a lot of fuel when you do that. So the climbing part certainly, and the German fighters were coming over from airfields in France or Netherlands, or basically not close. And so they would reach London or something like that, and only have maybe 20 minutes of combat time, whereas the British planes might have an hour of combat time and very quick to refuel and be back up in the air.
So you can if you get shot down, you're shot down over friendly territory.
Yeah, you're shot down over friendly territory. But you can think of like the, if you have X number of fighters, but then like here's an additional nuance is what percentage of the time can they be useful? And so even if you're attacking from far away and you have 20 minutes, for argument's sake, 20 minutes of flight time, of fighter time, of combat time, and the opposition has an hour of combat time, it's almost like having three times as many planes.
Oh, interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. So, and very easy for them to bring up reinforcements dynamically. So it's sort of like, because if being outnumbered is a great way to win. Like if you know if it's like six planes against 20 planes, the six planes are in trouble. They should run away. That would be very good. Just run away. So it was obviously pretty easy to see that. Okay, how many planes are coming? Where are they headed? And you had radar assistance and everything, and say, okay, let's concentrate the defense fighters in this, right here, and just and very very quickly fly up reinforcements. So, I think the obviously the Battle of Britain was not a smart move in any way for Germany to do that. It was not going to work. So
German strategic decision making leaves something to be desired. Yes, for sure.
Yes,
I think their tactical abilities and their abilities in scientific design and whatever sort of shielded them from the mistakes that they made strategically to some degree. Speaking of that, I want to ask you, because one of my favorite sections in any book on the development of military aircraft is the interwar years, because you get a chance to see a whole bunch of designs that eventually turned into like dead end designs. And I'm fascinated by some of these experiments. You see it in the Soviet Union a ton, but even we were just mentioning the Battle of Britain, where they unleashed the supposedly, game changing Messerschmitt 110s. And it proves to be those, for those who don't know, this is a larger fighter. And the idea was it was going to use firepower and size, but it turned out to just be total meat to the smaller, more nimble fighters that could get on their tail. Do you have any favorite of these dead-end designs or something that you wish, that had been stuck to a little bit longer and would have maybe in your mind made more of a difference? Maybe there is no dead-end designs you like. let's leave the door open to that possibility.
Well, I mean, there's an argument that on the German side, they should have perhaps focused on the Focke Wulf 190.
It was a great plane.
Yeah, great. Focke Wulf 190 was a really great plane, and just doubled down on that and made that primary plane. That was an excellent plane.
They built a ton more of the Messerschmitt 109 versions, though, than that. Ton more.
Yeah, it didn't make total sense because the 190 was, in my opinion, the better way to go. But I mean, a part of the fact that the Battle of Britain was just not a wise strategic decision. If you are going to do that, you should definitely have long range fighters that have good dual capability and with drop tanks and that kind of thing. But it was just a pointless. It's just like such an odd thing to do, because strategically the Battle of Britain just I think had not quite 0% chance of success, but pretty close.
That's why strategy trumps tactics, for sure.
Yeah.
So I have a Star Trek episode in mind that I want to involve you in. If I take you back to one of these engineering rooms, whether it's in London or in Washington, it wouldn't be in Washington, probably be in Southern California, someplace like that. But take you to one of the Allied aircraft engineering rooms and just say, okay, Elon, you're working with whatever those people have to work with. What's the easiest, quickest thing that you can suggest to them that they can do that will make a difference? In other words, you can't do anything too sophisticated. They can't get from here to there. But you could say something like, well, you guys are missing something really obvious here that you'll discover 5 years from now. I mean, is there anything right away that you look and you just go, if they'd only done this sooner, or something like that?
Nuclear bombs.
but that's a perfect example of what wouldn't work in this question, because nobody would have known. But there might have been some. I didn't know if there was some little thing that they weren't doing with aircraft that they would do later that would have made a huge difference, bang for the buck wise. But now you get into nuclear weapons, so let's talk a little about that, because go ahead.
We can try to answer the involved.
Was there something simple? Yeah, something they were missing.
You know, I never understood why they didn't replace the Sherman. It seemed like there was time to iterate on that and come up with something better.
Well, they did with the Pershing, but it was just really, really like last couple of months.
Yeah,
of the
but it just—I don't know. I never delved into this, but it seemed like the Shermans just had a terrible time and iterating on that faster. Where you maybe they had all the energy going to the fighters. I don't know. It just always seemed odd to me.
Well, we were talking about this earlier. It was a little bit about the, is it worth retooling the production lines for a new version, or would it be just better to just keep cranking out the old versions? And I remember somebody telling me, he says, yes. You'd rather have a Tiger II tank for sure. But if you've got 25 times as many Shermans, wouldn't you rather just have a tank sometimes versus no tank? And so I absolutely, I mean, as you know, as a guy who wargamed with the Americans forever, nothing makes you angrier than to sit there with a bunch of Sherman tanks and be picked off by German gunnery before you can even see them. But what one guy always said to me, he goes, well, but you got to give yourself then 20 tanks for every one of theirs if you want to replicate what was going on in the war. And then you've got to have what Elon was talking about earlier, the ground attack aircraft and everything else. But you know what's crazy is that we ended up exporting those Sherman tanks, as you both probably know well, for many years. They upgraded them, for example, in Israel with a better gun. And these things were still being used in the early in the wars in Israel. I don't know how many they were called Super Shermans. I don't know how many they were using in the late 60s, but these things were still rolling around, you know, come off the assembly lines in 43, and they're still using them 20 years later in some theaters.
Okay, that wouldn't be my recommendation. You have to be, I think, pretty desperate to be using a Sherman 20 years later. But, yeah, I mean, if I was strategically against, a Tiger tanks or something like that in World War II, and I had Shermans, my strategy would be to just run around in a circle, drive around in a circle until the Sherman, until the Tiger breaks down or runs out of fuel.
Usually they just, and usually Elon, they just parked them in some wonderful zone and let them. But you know what? That's what art, as my old friend used to say, that's what artillery is for.
Yeah, no, they're big. I mean, it was an incredible tank, Tiger, but it used a lot of fuel, and the reliability was
heavy. It was heavy, heavy, heavy.
It was heavy, and reliability was not great.
Yeah, I think that does show the complexity and the lack of parts and interchangeability, and the diverse, like they had so many different flavors that they couldn't service them and keep them running. So clearly the single tank has lots of advantages.
Yeah, I would just honestly the smart move just retreat and eventually that Tiger's going to run out of fuel or break down. And then it's a sitting duck.
I had a professor who said you can compare these things to the car manufacturers for the various countries involved. And they said that the Germans built fantastic tanks, and a lot of them were the same companies that build fantastic German cars, but they're really precision instruments, and they require a lot of maintenance, and you got to take care of them. And the combat situations just don't allow for that. So you'd much rather have a German tank than a Russian tank until they break down, and then you got to have the right spare parts and the right and the technicians, and then you'd rather have something that's just more of a tin can that works on a couple of strings, you know?
Well, I think you could have arguably the best of both worlds or most of the best of both worlds is possible. But it certainly is not a good idea to have, 27 different, or for argument's sake, different designs of a tank, especially if you're on the Eastern Front and a zillion miles from where the spare parts are.
This is really
unwise. Because you can get stuck because of one, you blew a little valve in the engine, and now you're 5,000 miles from where the spare part is. I'm like, wait a second.
And the Allies are bombing your ball bearing plants and all that sort of stuff,
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely. So you definitely want field repairable situations. But in terms of excellence in operation, if you look at World War II fighter aces on Wikipedia, and see how long you have to scroll before you find someone that isn't German. Have you done that?
Yes, but I would argue that there's other things going into it. So tell me what you think is going into that number.
Okay.
What accounts for that in your mind?
So part of it is that the in the beginning, the Russian planes were not very good. And so...
Or the Polish planes or the French planes or, you know, keep going, right? The Czech planes.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a few cases where German pilots were fighting Battle of Britain and would have, like, you know, I think one of them actually had zero kills in Battle of Britain, and he was one of the top three or top five German aces and had 200 or some crazy number of kills outside of Battle of Britain, mostly on the Eastern Front. So, you know, I think, yeah, it's the early planes that Russia had were, or Soviet Union had were not very good. And so you could really take them out very easily. As the war progressed, the Soviet planes obviously did get much, much better. And the Soviets had air superiority at the end.
I tell you, one of the theories I like, and I can't prove it, and I'm not smart enough to delve into it too deeply, but I love the concept. It's the idea of the non-firer, and the idea that there are most of the people in war don't even fire their weapons, and the damage is done inordinately by the people who do. And the specific examples that the author that I was reading gave, where he said it was most pronounced, was in the air war among fighter pilots, and he was talking about aces. And he said that most people would get up in the air and fly around and never shoot at anybody. But he almost described the people who were aces as true killers, and they went out there and caused the majority of the damage on both sides. Does that ring? I was trying to figure out, because, you know, we're talking so much about engineering and designs and those kinds of things, which seems to take out the human element. I grew up next door to a fighter pilot, and he was trying to design an aircraft anyway his whole life in the 1970s after he retired from Lockheed. But he would talk to me so much about pilot, skill, training. How does one, I mean, would you rather be the better pilot in the worst plane or the worst pilot in the better plane?
To be totally frank, I would say the worst pilot in the better plane. Just bear in mind, also, worst plane means this thing might fall out of the sky for reasons.
Yes, how much worse? How much worse? Fire. Yes. Biplane versus versus jet fighter,
especially,
yes.
Especially over the Pacific. I mean, the Pacific is very big, and you're flying a long-range mission in the Pacific, and your plane is in trouble. So, I mean, they're probably never going to see you again. So,
no, this was your P-38 extra engine argument,
like,
right there.
If I was in the Pacific, I'm definitely pleased with P-38. That would be my favorite by far, just because at least this, the probability of coming back alive from engine trouble is way better. The P-30, I think, obviously this is like some serious armchair quarterbacking here, but I would have taken the P-38. And actually doubled down on that one. Like I said, given it the turbo supercharged Merlins, but double the power of that plane, double it, and improve the fuel efficiency and allow it to fly super high. There were some improvements needed to the airframe as well to make it more maneuverable. It had some issues, I think, in dives and rolls. But it's easy to upgrade the control surfaces. Not that hard.
Didn't they do some of that with the P-61 Black Widow? I mean, wasn't that sort of a super P-38?
Yeah, but I think that didn't get. It was late. But yeah, that's the kind of that basically just a major uprev of the P-38. I think would have been Black Widow is basically like that.
Think it wasn't it, or I think it might have had radial air cooled, so kind of a different thing. But yeah, the double boom with the double engine.
And I don't know anything about the supercharger or any of its power or any of those kind of things. I know they used it for a night fighter, I think.
Yeah.
I think there's another element here which might be interesting, which is it's the pilots. Obviously, I have a lot of respect for the pilots. My great uncle Bill Overstreet was with the 357th Fighter Group flying Mustangs and had a lot of great stories. But it's also interesting to look at the engineers and like the Mustang was designed by a German immigrant to the US. Imagine if he'd been over there working on German designs. And so you like the P-38 was, I think Kelly Johnson had a role in it, who went on to do the SRs, you know, later.
The Skunk Works.
Skunk Works. So it's also interesting to look at the folks driving the engineering design and the rate of innovation, like we were talking about, and like the higher innovation rates, are those driven by a few key folks? I don't know, but it's an interesting thing to look at.
You know what? But Bill, you bring up something now, and maybe it's the obvious jumping off point from what we were just talking about, where you and I are admiring the skill of the pilot so much. I feel like we're entering the era of the pilotless plane. Yeah, I mean, I was doing some heavy duty research trying to understand the impact of the drone warfare happening over the Nagorno-Karabakh area of the Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict that happened recently. And it seems the logical next step. And, you know, Elon, you and I have talked about how the First World War was so particularly deadly because you had all those years of development, but without practical testing to see how major powers' new equipment would all work. And then you want to leash them on each other. I feel like the drones over Armenia are the same kind of thing, where we haven't had a major war between major powers where both sides are using cutting edge drone technology. And then we get into that dynamic we've talked about, right? The continually upgrading, you know, the variant G, variant H. What do you think about the future of the whole drone warfare when it comes to, and maybe not just aircraft, but I mean, one could make a case that they're working on it for armored vehicles on land too, and ships.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting future. There's no question, like, if you wanted to have a more effective fighter, bomber, tank, whatever the case may be, the best thing to do is take the pilot out of it at this point.
We're already there, you think?
Yeah.
You'd rather have a computer doing it than a human being in there at this point already. So Bobby Fischer's losing to the computer already in the chess game. We're losing, you know, okay, that's it. But see, to me right there, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like, I just want to separate this out. It's not like I want the computers, the drones to take over. But if you say, like, if you have a well-designed unmanned fighter or something like that, and basic AI, we're talking primitive AI, it's really going to crush the best human. It can go through super high G turns. It can do things a human can't do and not black out. You know, it can do a 10 G, like whatever the fuselage can handle, it can handle. And it has simultaneous awareness and processing of all the sensors. You know, like a guided missile is in some ways like that. You know, what is a guided missile? It's sort of the computer, it's a computer controlled, basically kamikaze plane. So
You're saying if you take the meat computer out of the cockpit, the performance of the mechanical systems left over are so superior.
Yeah. I mean, so much of the plane is oriented towards keeping the pilot alive and allowing the pilot to interact with the plane's computer systems. And modern fighter jets, it's fly-by-wire. So it's really, you're just telling the computer what to do. But that plane would get dramatically lighter, cheaper, faster, pretty much better in every way if it did not have a pilot in it. And I want to emphasize, I like flying planes, and I'm a pilot personally. So this is not like, you know, it's not some anti-pilot thing. It's just that
this isn't the M5 computer on Star Trek, and you're replacing Captain Kirk and everything.
No, I mean
that works out well.
You want to have fire control, you know, so-called kill decision still require a human, I think. You know, we don't want the computers we don't want Terminator here, you know. So, but I think the reality is, like, if you've got a tank without humans or a fighter without humans, it's going to win because it doesn't have to go to all the trouble of trying to keep the humans who are quite delicate and easily killed alive. It's very difficult to do that.
I'm curious what you might think. You know, you and I have talked about this also, the idea of people trying to deal with technology or integrate or come up with systems and approaches for technology in circumstances where there's no way to train for it before the circumstance breaks out. So I had a conversation with a guy who's a First World War historian, and he's a big fan of General Douglas Haig, who gets called a butcher by some people. But the argument for the anti-butcher crowd is that he was in a situation where he's in a learning curve, right? He's a cavalry commander from the late 19th century trying to figure out how to integrate aircraft with armored battleships, with tanks on the field, and all these kinds of things that are far beyond the world he grew up in. And this goes back to what we were talking about how quickly the pace of change began to speed up. How do you think the generals, and by the way, they're a very interesting group, our modern day generals, in terms of continual learning and all that sort of stuff. How do you think they're going to do with all the new crap that's been developed since the Second World War, when the last time major superpowers faced off? How do you think they're going to do integrating all these new systems against another power that also possesses all these new systems? When both sides have drones, when both sides have computers, when both sides have the Gulf War technology that we were using.
Yeah, so there's an interesting thing that happened. So when we, obviously, once we developed nukes, like wars between superpowers became a decision to destroy humanity or not, or destroy civilization.
You'd get some pushback on that from some military leaders, you would.
No, but I mean, it's just like the stakes are very high. Like, you can't just go around using nukes without getting nuked yourself, basically. So like in wars between superpowers, like serious wars, were not going to happen because it would just be mutually assured destruction. At least there was too much risk of such a thing to have a superpower war. However, drones now move that completely in the other direction. Now you can have a drone war where very few people died, or maybe no one dies in a drone war, and whoever's drones are successful, they won the battle. And this may actually reduce the risk of a war, reduce the penalty of a war, and increase the risk of having a war, because it ends up being battle bots, you know, and so that could be one of the things that happens, is that it's now the stakes have gone from super high with nukes to actually not even having human casualties could result in potentially more wars down the road. But wars with war.
Yeah, I do. I think it opens up the door. Yeah. Yes. So let me ask you then, because something happened this last couple of weeks in space. And you could have to correct me on this, but it had to do with the Russians. I always want to call them the Soviets. This is how old I am now. It's the Russians shooting, I believe, a missile into space and blowing up something and affecting satellites. And all I could think about when I was reading it was this is going to be looked back in the history books as the very early stages of the first. I don't even know what you would call it. We called it the peaceful version of it a space race. I don't know what you call this, but I'd be interested in your take on what this means. And I mean, and what a space war would look like, and if something like that is a near future or long future thing. I mean, can you give us a little insight you're dealing with this every day. What was your reaction to that that incident?
Well, we're certainly surprised to see that happen. I think a lot of people in Russia were surprised to see it happen. By the sounds of it, it was something that was just on the military side, and Russian civil space wasn't even aware of it. So I do, you know, think that is that was not great for Russia to do that. But
not great. Not great. Suboptimal.
Because there is now a bunch of debris that's going to take a while to deorbit. And some of that debris potentially puts the space station in trouble, which has Russians on it. So I think that that was a regrettable incident. But, you know, it's clearly, you know, at least Russia, China, and the U.S. have demonstrated anti-satellite weapons. The U.S. actually has extremely good anti-satellite weapons. A demonstration that was done a few years ago actually was the U.S. deorbited a satellite. And while the satellite was deorbiting, so it's coming back into the atmosphere, fired an anti-satellite missile at the satellite and went and hit the fuel tank of the satellite while it was deorbiting. You know, this is sort of like the, you know, Western equivalent of like flipping the silver dollar in the air, taking out the six gun and going, bam, shooting the dollar, a hole through the dollar. So that was cool. But that was like a satellite that was deorbiting, so it didn't cause orbital debris. And this is all public information, so you can look at it on the internet. There's also directed energy weapons, which are basically lasers and microwave lasers, masers. Yeah. So it's basically,
so is that the first thing that happens, Elon, in the next war? Is the first thing that the satellites get blinded and knocked out? I mean, is that if you're wargaming the next major superpower war, and this goes back to what you and I were saying earlier in this conversation about how you compensate for an opponent that's technologically superior to you. I mean, if we're the superior higher ground satellite country and someone else can knock out our satellites, isn't that a great equalizer? Is that the first step in the next? In World War III, is the knocking out of the satellites?
Man, true World War III, I sure hope we never have one of those.
I'm a pessimist on human nature, and I just think that it's just, what was the old line that Bertrand Russell said, right? Expecting a man to walk a tightrope forever. I mean, the odds seem against it to me.
I agree that given enough time, the probability of a third world war is high if you just give it enough time. As, you know, to extend the, like, how far could you walk on that tightrope before falling off? Not forever.
No, but I think the logical thing would be to push it too. I think you'd have a miscalculation where it's the old line about where during the early phases of the nuclear era, where they were talking about what if some country pushes in little teeny chunks so that it's never enough so you'd want to risk a nuclear exchange over, but it's enough to change the map. I mean, I feel like something like that's a classic human First World War type miscalculation rather than people sitting down calculating the odds of winning a third world war. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess that is how these things tend to happen.
That's a very unsatisfying answer to be right on that. I just want you to know.
Yes,
it's very unsatisfying for the pessimist for you to work. Yes, thank you. That's it. I hope I'm wrong. Exactly.
But yeah, I think certainly one of the things that would occur in any kind of significant third world war, even non-nuclear, would be to take out the space assets of the others. And this can be done with either kinetic weapons, like a missile of some kind, or
like an EMP.
An EMP is you can lob a nuke into the upper atmosphere or above the atmosphere in space and basically just fire it, and it actually would cause it would not cause anyone to die on the ground from the explosion itself, but it would. It would, the electromagnetic pulse would probably take out any satellites in the vicinity and possibly power grids on the ground. So that is a big move to do that stuff. It, also, EMPs do not discriminate. So, it's going to take out all the satellites in that area, not just, the enemy satellites. So I don't know if they'd be going for the EMP, but I think the more likely situation would be anti-satellite missiles or ground-based directed energy. Laser is light amplification through simulated emission radiation. So it's typically in the, maybe 400 to 1500 nanometer range, with that 1500 nanometer being an infrared laser, which is just sort of heated up, essentially. Although those don't work too well if the things are cloudy, you end up heating the cloud instead of the what you're aiming at.
And I hear you talk about that though, Elon, I think about, because I think you're probably right in terms of EMPs don't discriminate and all those kinds of stuff, which would seem to indicate that it would not be a smart move for a nation state. How far? Because I realize there's capabilities involved here. How far away are we from having terrorists have a capability like that?
Well, if terrorists can launch a nuke into the upper atmosphere, that they could also nuke whatever else that cities or whatever, So,
but would one nuke hitting? I don't get me wrong. I love these conversations where we give terrorists ideas, but I feel we have all the ideas. But I mean, would you rather have a nuclear weapon if you're a terrorist hit an American city, or would you do more damage to knock out the satellites? And I don't know which is the right answer, but maybe you could. I mean, would we be more discomforted by the satellites going out than the U.S.? I mean, because if you're in New Orleans, Los Angeles being hit's a disaster, but it doesn't affect New Orleans that much. Whereas you take out the satellites and we're all in trouble. I mean, have I got that wrong?
No, I think we'd much rather they took out the satellites than a city. And
I think that makes sense. Yes. I'm going to go that makes sense.
Yeah,
yes.
For sure.
Bill, have we left you out of this discussion? Has there been anything we've talked about that prompts any thinking from you where either I'm totally way off base or we're missing something really intriguing here in the last bit of conversation?
I think I just like to look at it back through the lens of the rock, paper, scissors, and there's a lot of new rocks, papers, and scissors out there. And it's just it's just a tread development.
The rock, paper, scissors treadmill.
Yep.
Rock, paper, scissors treadmill. So maybe let's take it a little farther back, Elon, because you and I were talking about engineers a while back, and you were teaching me about what an engineer does and all these kinds of things, and I started to go back to we were talking about the importance of engineering as the pace of change speeds up, but then I keep thinking about guys like Archimedes. Or even earlier, the stuff in prehistory, once upon a time, somebody invented a bow and arrow, or somebody took a bow and turned it into a compound bow or a composite bow. These people lost it. So talk to me a little about engineering and warfare. Is this just a facet of what engineers do to our whole life, or is there something very specific to warfare and the development of engineering in your mind?
Yeah, and to be clear, I don't mean to in any way downplay the value of generalship, tactics, strategy, and like
no, they're all integrated,
individual
absolutely.
Valor or anything like that. I just think that engineering in general is underrated in its impact on the outcome of wars. So it's to be clear, I'm just trying to adjust for the importance of technology in warfare that is often overlooked. As an important factor. If, for example, Sun Tzu, Art of War, there is no chapter on technology. I mean, that's an interesting book. I've read that many times. Lots of interesting elements to it. A lot of wisdom there, but...
I don't think Clausewitz deals with it either now.
Yeah,
that
no,
I
exactly. Clausewitz's On War really alludes to it, but does not really... there should be a chapter saying if you have a decisive technology advantage, you can actually win with minimal casualties to your side, at least. And you mentioned earlier in the conversation, the war with Prussia against Austria, they had fast loading guns, and Austria did not. That was made a big difference in the.
Was that the needle gun?
It was. I forget. This is like. No, 30 years
a precursor ago. To the needle gun.
It's something. It was like 30 years ago. Essentially, that the firing rate for that Prussia had against the war with Austria was dramatically higher.
Right.
And so the effectiveness of the troops is really like in one video game. You'd say for any given weapon, what is the damage per second? DPS. Just boil it down to DPS. And in the Napoleonic Wars, for example, the British had rifles. A rifle is just basically scoring the inside of the barrel to rotate the bullet.
That's what the rifling is, right?
Yeah, that's right. Rifling is basically just you put you score the inside of the barrel with a rotation to put spin into the bullet. And sorry, I got a little X here, so it might have like little baby sounds.
That's okay. That's I like that.
Before comedic relief. So anyway, the British had rifles in the Napoleonic Wars, especially towards the end. They had, it's a situation where it sounds like the rifles weren't enough to really make a difference, but actually they did because I think they had maybe a couple hundred meters extra range, and the British would snipe the French officers
and the artillery pieces
and
actually.
The artillery pieces exactly so you don't actually need a lot of they're basically early day sniper rifles
right
and
they were given to units that were like sniper units because your average soldier carried the unrifled musket but you're right the specialist units carried the and we did that in this country too but if I recall correct me if I'm wrong you almost had to like hammer the bullet down the barrel. I mean, it was a long reload process in a day when it was already a long reload process.
Yeah, the rifle had, I think it was a while before the rifle reload time was was faster than the basic musket ball reload time. But
I think that's the war you just talked about, the Austrian-Prussian one, right? I mean, I think that's what part of it was. It bolt action? Something was going on there that allowed the rate of reloading to go faster. Yeah,
exactly. This is literally 30 years ago that I read about it. But it was a decisive element because it just meant the damage per second or damage per minute of the Prussian forces was much higher than the damage per minute of the Austrian forces.
You could also lie down because then you didn't have to stand straight up for reloading, which meant you got away from the linear warfare of the Napoleonic Revolutionary War era and all that.
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea of
dispersion starts
and just firing musket balls at each other seems insane to me. This is like the death lottery and with a high chance of winning.
Don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes, right?
But anyway, I just say like there's just examples of like the British use of rifles in towards the end of the Napoleonic Wars was much more decisive than it would seem based on the sheer number of rifles because they specifically aimed at the French officers and at the artillery. And so that's like giving, you know, if you lose your officer, you don't know what to do.
But I think, and correct me, I think that rifles,
it's the equivalent of a headshot, you know.
I don't think anyone had a monopoly on rifles. I mean, I think that's how Lord Nelson, the famous admiral, was shot, wasn't he? Was shot by that might not have been a rifle. He was shot by a French guy in the rigging of an enemy ship. But you're right. That's the taking out of the officers. If you could kill one Lord Horatio Nelson, how many average sailors is that worth?
Yeah. By the way, I think Wellington's underrated.
Well, as an Irish guy, I'm going to agree with you. okay, well, listen, is there anything, because, you know, you and I have been talking about doing this for a long time, is there anything we didn't talk about that was part of what you wanted to get into here? And this includes you too, Bill. I don't know what you wanted to get into, but I want to make sure that during the course of the conversation, we touch upon these things. I mean, there's so much I could still ask you about. I mean, I wrote down chemical warheads on V2 rockets. Did I lose you guys? Are you still there?
Bill, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, yeah, no, either. There was no, are you guys objecting to the fact that there was no actual question in that question?
Well, I was wondering
you guys thought you were
going to
get questions?
I didn't know if we actually addressed the last topic change, Dan, or if we kind of hopped around, but.
Well, hop back.
Well, I don't know exactly where we were headed on it, but it was kind of interesting. Like the idea, I mean, I think Elon was basically saying it's all these different aspects and it's the and the generals and the bravery, but the engineering, it's an interesting lens to look at it through and talk about it. That's kind of what I was thinking back to.
Well, I mean, so maybe one could make the case that we've seen the ratio of importance of all those various elements, generalship, heroism, engineering. So we've seen the ratio and the importance in the terms of a triage level maybe changing over time. Maybe this gets us into a nice bow tie with the beginning of the conversation about the importance of science and engineering once you reach the late 19th, early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
It's just when the rate of change of technology is high, such that there is a big technology difference between one side and the other, then technology dominates, and you get a lopsided victory. So,
but then what happens in Afghanistan? You see what I'm saying? I mean, I think that what you're saying makes sense most of the time, but there are enough examples we can use that just say, otherwise it would be, why even fight the war, right? It's a foregone conclusion. How come it didn't win in Vietnam? There's other elements, right?
Well, the U.S. Does not engage in unrestricted warfare. So, by no means do I mean suggest that that everything America does is good, but and I'll probably get a lot of flack for saying this, but probably a lot. But I actually think America is the greatest sort of force for benevolent outcome of any country in history. On balance, that doesn't mean everything America did is good. You know, so you could always say like America went to the moon. Why can't America do everything? That it's like, look. You know, America is like a person. Person, you know, might do something brilliant, but it doesn't mean everything they do is brilliant. So, but because you know, yeah, you know, here in America, we aspire to be the good guys, and may that ever continue. And if the warfare is truly allowed to be unrestricted, you can just carpet bomb the enemy until they're not there anymore. I mean, we could use nukes.
But let's not pretend that that's a moral question always. I mean, the reason you don't nuke North Vietnam is because then you're going to risk the full-on nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. I mean, in other words, you might have wanted to turn North Vietnamese territory into glass, but it might not have been an option on the table, right? There's multiple factors going into all these decisions that constrain your options, right?
Yeah, but nukes would not have been required to defeat the Viet Cong. That could have been done with conventional weapons, but it would have resulted in a lot of civilians dying. So then the question is, are you willing to kill large numbers of civilians? The United States is not willing to do that. So therefore, loss.
I'm thinking of Korea, and I think we destroyed almost all those villages and ended up in a stalemate. I think there's an interaction going on here, and I think that the technology is just one aspect of this. But I do believe, and I think this is something you've alluded to, that as the technological sophistication becomes so overwhelming and so dominant that it starts to shrink the importance of all those other factors that we talked about that play into the overall equation, right? Like you said, if it's laser beams versus cavemen, That's a pretty decisive situation.
Yeah, or even if you simply have air superiority, and you don't have the advantage of extreme ground cover in a sort of a heavily jungled situation, just having air superiority will you're going to win, you know. So, but
it depends on what win means too, right?
Depends on what win means. But yeah, I mean, certainly no question the United States could have won the war in Vietnam. If it had the will to do so, and was willing to be do a lot more civilian casualties, but I think that would not be a good thing. But you know, the United States just doesn't believe in, you know, the United States cares about if lots of civilians die, you know, and this is actually relatively unusual in all the wars and all the history and all the protagonists, most of them did not care about killing civilians. The United States does, and may never be that way.
Now you've got my brain. So you got, this is what I like about these conversations, is you've got the wheels turning now. So now you've got me wondering about technology in the Second World War, if the other side had developed it first. So we all know the Germans were working hard on jet aircraft. I would say jet fighters or jet bombers, but apparently they couldn't make up their minds. So let's talk about then nuclear weapons. We know that there's some rumors of the Japanese working on them, but we know that the Germans would have liked to have gotten them. So if they had gotten them first, realizing that, you know, there were not many bombs even when we had them, how much of a difference does that make if in 44, I don't want to say 45 because I think the war is over already, but let's imagine during a time period where there's still something going on, how decisive is something like that if the Germans get the atomic weapons first, in your mind?
They win, of course.
Do you think so?
Yes.
I wonder, because they got the V2 rockets, right? I mean,
no, but the damage potential, I mean, think of it this way: if they have both long-range rockets,
the V2s and the yeah,
it's game. Instant. The other side just lost. 100%.
Interesting. I still wonder why they didn't. I mean, look, when you realize that regime was so terrible that nothing is beyond the pale of what they might do, I don't know why in 44 they didn't just say, we have all this territory we're occupying. If you don't want something really bad to happen to all these occupied people, you know, you'll come to the negotiating table right now. I mean, I always wonder why things didn't. If a science fiction writer were having some fun with that, they'd be holding, you know, whole countries hostage for a good deal. And maybe that dovetails into something you said earlier, but you really think it's game over if the Germans get new? Is there a time period where they could get nuclear weapons where it's too late? I mean, if they get them in January 45, is it too late, or is it such a game changer it doesn't matter when they get them?
Well, if they've lost air superiority, then I think it would be tough.
Well, they lost that in 43, probably, don't you think?
Not fully, no. They you know, they didn't have it over Britain or whatever, but I don't think they lost air superiority in 43 over Germany or in that area. It basically, okay. it's like you need a delivery contested. Vehicle, and that's either got to be a long-range bomber or a long-range missile. So, but, you know, it's you know, clearly they wouldn't have bothered using troops on Stalingrad if they had a nuke. They'd be like, oh, that used to be a city, not anymore. So,
okay, well, now I want to ask a question that might be a good time to wrap this up, because it might be a good. So it's always been my contention that the Germans of the First World War were a stronger power and a more formidable foe than the Germans of the Second World War. And one of the reasons I always used was that the Germans in the Second World War deliberately got rid of a lot of the things that would have helped them in the Second World War for reasons that had nothing to do with military superiority at all. So, for example, a lot of Jewish people fought patriotically for Germany in the First World War. A lot of those same Jewish people that would have done it in the Second World War were in other countries by the time the Second World War was fought, because they weren't welcome at home, and that's saying it mildly. But you take a guy like Einstein, and we know there were several besides Einstein, who would have been involved in, assuming that they were patriotic Germans fighting for the German cause, as they would have in the First World War, a guy like Einstein and his compatriots might have been helping the Germans develop atomic weapons. How much of a difference do you think it might have made had the people that were in the U.S. atomic weapons program or the U.S. space program or anything like that, if they'd stayed in Germany and had fought and used their scientific skills for that side as opposed to our side? How much of a difference does that make in your mind?
No, I think that would have made a tremendous difference. And the person you'd want is not Einstein, but Leo Szilard.
Okay, yeah.
So Szilard was the one who really was pushing the nukes. And frankly, I think there were others that kind of knew, there are probably a fair number that knew it this would probably work, but they did not want to send their mind in that direction. But Szilard, and I believe Szilard was Hungarian. So,
yes.
So if you know, they literally had him right
there. Yeah, guys like Fuchs, though. Klaus Fuchs was there. I mean, there are people like that,
yeah,
too, right?
Exactly. So, you know, if they'd gotten if they had in fact not been anti-Semitic and just generally alienated a lot of people and pushed apart,
alienated
to say the least, there's a good chance Germany, I would say Germany probably would have had the nuke before anyone else. Yeah.
Is there anything, Elon, and this applies to you too, Bill, is there anything I didn't get into and that's an interesting piece of information on this subject we've been dealing with that I just either didn't ask you about or was not intelligent enough to even know it was sitting out there in plain sight? I always hate to just leave anything on the table. So what haven't we dealt with that would have been intriguing?
Well, I mean, we could certainly talk for a long time, and I'd be open to talking again in the future if you'd like. Man, there's so much we could talk about.
Well, you know what? You can save it for next time, then. This gives us a wonderful jumping-off point next time, and I hope Bill would be nice enough to join us as well.
Sure. We could drill maybe more into, you know, more specifics about particular battles and that kind of thing.
Well, we could maybe get into some of the things you guys wanted to talk about instead of my pet issues also.
We're just basically trying to emphasize that, you know, in some conflicts, technology and engineering, these were kind of engineering wars. And that is often overlooked, as you mentioned, not in Sun Tzu, not in Clausewitz on war, but obviously extremely decisive if you have a big technology advantage.
Maybe that's the fun part to jump off next time. I'll do some research and try to find out when you first start seeing discussions of technology advantages and whatnot in the written historical record. That might be fascinating.
Well, there's that. Isn't that poem? I forget the exact terminology. Whatever else matters. We have the Maxim gun, and
we've
they
got
do
the
not.
Maxim gun, and they have not. Yes. Well, you know, it's funny because there was some stuff written, and I'd have to look it up. I remember reading it in Arthur Farrell's book on warfare, where he was talking about as the Roman Empire is starting to decline, they were starting to push some ideas, or some people, their versions of Elon Musk, were starting to push ideas of secret weapons and super weapons and ways that they could somehow compensate for the other areas in warfare that they were losing, whether it's territory where they could recruit soldiers from, or what have you. And it was stuff like, you know, scythe chariots and all kinds of interesting. We all know that they had Greek fire and a bunch of other interesting things. Be fun to look at the impact of technology in earlier warfare before we could even really recognize it as technology.
Totally. In my opinion, the Romans won their wars for many reasons, but one of the decisive elements was the Romans were the best engineers.
Absolutely. It's like Assyrians were great engineers too.
Yeah. I know
and the Chinese always.
I know less about that, but the Romans really were great engineers. And I mean, they'd lay down roads, and if like you're trying to march somewhere, man, roads beat the heck out of some, you know, little windy path through the forest.
It's totally the non-sexy side of war too, but it's so important.
You seriously need roads.
It was kind of a theme, the supply chain, like the high octane fuel, the roads gets the legions where you need them to fight the Celts, the supply, you know, like didn't Napoleon say an army marches on its stomach?
Right.
which I think maybe actually falsely attributed to Napoleon. But it's nonetheless true.
I have found that it's dangerous for me to quote anybody anymore because everybody I've ever quoted and every quote I've ever repeated seems to be wrong when people double check it. So apparently nobody ever said anything that's attributed to them in history. That's all I can figure.
It's true. I end up digging deep into the etymology of things for whatever reason. As Claire knows,
you own etymology.com.
I literally bought etymology.com.
You did not.
But I actually know a lot about it.
At first I judged you for buying that, but then I realized you actually really do care about etymology.
I really do care about etymology.
That's hilarious. well, listen, I guess this means we have another show coming eventually whenever, you know, with your spare time and your schedule, it'll be in about 25 years, but we'll be right on.
Great. We can go into the etymology of things like bolts to the wall, because that's
a particular... Oh, that's actually super interesting. Just say that one.
It's so interesting. Bolts to the wall.
Okay.
It is cool.
Okay, go. That's a perfect thing to end on. What is the etymology of balls to the wall?
Okay, well... these days it may be confusing when you hear balls to the wall, because presumably you're not suggesting that someone, if they're, you know, have balls, put them on the wall, because why would you ever want to put your balls on a wall? So the etymology of this goes back to many different things. Certainly, in World War II, for example, balls to the wall would be, if it would be max throttle. So the tips of the throttle lever would be balls, and so balls to the wall would be max throttle. However, there's something that arguably predates that, which is the way you would control a steam engine was by having two balls spinning on a cable or a rod, or I think cable, and then depending upon how much throttle you wanted, you would either crank the balls in or crank them out. And so if you crank them out, balls to the wall would again mean a full throttle for the steam engine.
I don't know how we didn't start with that, man.
The whole balls to the wall situation.
I kept going even like deeper into balls to the wall.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I sense an entirely new topic taking over. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, listen, man, I've really enjoyed this. I've enjoyed having all three of you on, and let's do this again soon. Okay.
Yeah. Actually, one final etymology. When you say to someone, give it the whole nine yards, do you know what that means?
I don't.
Okay. Well, this is again a debatable etymology, but the one of the possible origins is the length of an ammo belt in World War II was on the order of 9 yards. So giving it the whole 9 yards means just emptying the entire ammo belt on it.
Oh God! Yeah. You know what you know what you made me think of. I'll tell you what you made me think of, and it's the craziest thing to have come from what you just said, but I got a tour once of the Westminster School, which is attached to Westminster Abbey in London, and it's been around since forever. I mean, like the Middle Ages, practically. So they're giving me the tour. The students are giving me the tour, and between classes they have, it's not a handball court, but it's a place where they kind of play something like handball, and it's in a specific area that just is, you know, where there's walls to bounce stuff off of and everything. And the guy says to me, we have all these house rules, like if the ball goes over there, it's 2 points. If the ball goes over there, it's out of bounds. And I said, well, when did they make these rules? He said, in the Middle Ages. He said, so all of the little house rules that they still played with, and you said balls to the wall, that's what it was. It was a ball on the wall. And all I could think of was, here are a bunch of students today who have no idea really of history or anything like that, and yet they're playing a game where the house rules that they still play under were invented centuries ago. I just thought that was hilarious.
Yes, so, I could go on and on about wood or
the etymology.
No, we're not. Spanish. It's English. It's English stolen from Latin about 500 years ago.
There's like a Wikipedia hole for
and it means nothing like the Latin phrase.
Do we want to know what it means, or is this something you'd better leave the audience hanging with?
Well, que sera, like whatever will be, but it's actually technically an English phrase because it was bastardized from Latin, but the phrase in Latin doesn't mean the same thing. And a lot of people think it's Spanish or Italian or something like that, but it's actually an English phrase that's been used for like 500 years. And it actually, it basically implies a cheery fatalism.
My thanks to Elon Musk and Bill Riley from SpaceX for coming on the program today. And you know, it was funny, as I was listening to that during editing, it reminded me of my concept of hardcore history when it first appeared in my brain before we'd done any work and it had evolved in any way, shape, or form. I'd thought about it as a continuation of the sorts of conversations that we used to have as history geeks when I was a history major in college. And questions like, would you rather be the better pilot in the inferior aircraft or the inferior pilot in the superior aircraft? I mean, that kind of thing. In my head, I thought, okay, this is what we'll do with this hardcore history thing. Now, it didn't obviously go in that direction, but this is the kind of thing where I could talk about this all day. This is the light conversation I like to have, which is my sister always says, you're so weird, but, you know, there are worse things, right? Speaking of, you know, the strange and perhaps hard to purchase for the holidays, you know, you may have a loved one or family member that you're having a hard time finding a good gift for them because they're interested in the extremes of the human experience, and you just can't get that at the local big box store always. You can get it off our website, though. The old shows that are no longer on the free feed are available from the website. You can. We have a new system to purchase them, too, if you want to use it, called the Glow System. Should make it easier for people with certain kinds of podcast players. We have gift certificates for loved ones. We have some new merch with new designs that is just, you know, dropped, T-shirts, hats, that kind of thing. So if you're interested in all that stuff, it's out there, dancarlin.com. I won't go into it too deeply, just to say that there are some, you know, some illnesses and infirmities in the family right now that are preventing me from getting to the big hardcore history recording, which never goes as quickly as we'd like anyway. So I apologize for the lateness of it all. Not just that, but it's one of those topics that we're trying to be very careful with, a little incendiary in our current zeitgeist, for lack of a better word. So apologies, patience, please. We'll get to it, and hopefully you think it's worth it when we do. Finally, I do want you all to know, and I mean this, I mean, people say things all the time that are just sort of platitudes. It's been, historically speaking, a hard last 2 years for us all. I mean, on a global level. I don't know what the next year holds, but, you know, I hope it's better for all of us. And I think here's the thing. You know, history can obviously break any number of different ways, and I'm a little pessimistic usually, so I always assume the worst. But let's not forget that things can turn on a dime in strange directions, and that means directions that are improvements for all of us as well, whatever you might consider improvements to be. Regardless, let's remember, whatever your beliefs, your thoughts, wherever you may live and whatever your circumstances. Believe it or not, as strange as this sounds, as much of a platitude as this sounds, we're all in this together. And I always like to think that if you and I, whomever you may be, simply sat down over a cup of coffee or tea or something, we could have a good conversation, find commonalities and ways to get along and enjoy each other. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. And that's coming from a person who's basically pessimistic. So if you're optimistic, the sky's the limit. Stay safe, everybody. Have a wonderful 2022. And I hope I'm talking to you a lot over the next year.
Support us with Patreon by going to patreon.com/DanCarlin or go to our donate page at dancarlin.com/DC-donate.
You may have heard me talk about Battle Guide Virtual Tours recently. It's a group of folk in Europe who were doing live tours when COVID hit and had to try to figure out, like so many other people, how you reimagine a business for, you know, during a time of a pandemic. And they came up with something that it's one of those things that you never would have thought about it if you hadn't been forced to because of something like the pandemic. But because you came up with the idea, it's a brilliant idea. And it brings battlefield tours to all sorts of people who couldn't be expected to make it out to all those battlefields in person. And even if you're lucky enough to make it to one or two, wouldn't it be nice to be able to go to 20 or 30? Well, maybe you could do that virtually, and now with Battle Guide Virtual Tours, you can. It's one of those things you kind of have to see to get a sense of, but basically they combine satellite and drone imagery, a live historian, eyewitness accounts, period footage. I mean, it's all blended together to give you a real sense of a given battle and what's going on and what the challenges are and what it was like on the ground, and visually give you a real sense of what you're seeing. Battles are notoriously difficult sometimes to get a real sense of. This is probably the best way to do it. And if you want to get a sense of what that's like, you know, throwing my name around can get you a 50% discount right now. If you go to battleguide.co.uk/Dan-Carlin and get a look at it and just see what we're talking about here. There are two kinds of tours, basically. The live ones, where if you catch it when it's going on, you can participate. It's a Q&A kind of thing. And it's happening, you know, while you're watching. But then those things are saved to be accessed later, and you can go watch all the previous tours and access it that way at your convenience also. Lots of different options, including gift certificates for people, you know, that might be a little bit difficult to buy gifts for, find something unusual. Maybe they'd like, you know, a gift certificate giving them several battlefield tours. But as I said, why don't you take the 50% offer here and check it out for yourself at battleguide.co.uk/Dan-Carlin and take a, you know, virtual battlefield tour yourself at Battle Guide Virtual Tours.